I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Life is full of what ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Make a difference. Relish a great work-life balance. Enjoy generous benefits and competitive pay. Go home each night feeling fulfilled by your work. Work for an employer of choice. Work for Blue Ridge Hospice. We're always looking to hire compassionate RNs, CNAs, or anyone interested in office or thrift shop work. We've been your not-for-profit community hospice since 1981. Visit our website for more information or to apply today at blueridgehospice.org. That's blueridgehospice.org. Blue Ridge Hospice is an equal opportunity employer.
Hello, I'm Claire from Wild Ginger Running, the trail and ultra running YouTube channel, and this is the podcast version of my weekly live chat with an athlete, coach, or other running expert. The link to the original film on YouTube is in the show notes. Check out my Instagram and YouTube channel for more training advice, inspiration, and gear reviews. Everything is Wild Ginger Running, and my blog is wildgingerrunning.co.uk. Support me on Patreon if you enjoy this free advice at patreon.com/wildgingerrunning. Enjoy this podcast and see you next week for more.
Right, good evening everybody. I'm Vicky from Wild Ginger Running, and tonight I'm joined by Ali Bevan, who is going to be talking to us about his book, which is fantastic, and you can download that or buy that and have a good read. And there's some amazing, amazing stories in that book. And we're gonna go through with some of those tonight. If you've got questions, hi John, I can see John's online. You can bob them in the comments box and we'll do our best to answer them and get to all of those throughout this evening. So Ali, thank you very much for joining us. We'll just start off with a little bit about you. How you got into running when you were younger and sort of how it's all sort of grown. I know you're very modest about your own achievements and quite self-deprecating about things.
Justifiably so, yeah.
So we're going to talk through some of those as well. So Ali, if you tell us a little bit about growing up and how you got into the sport and things like that, that'd be a great starting point.
I only started running when I was a student, I think. So I, the first time I ever went for a run, I was probably 19.
Right.
I was living in Edinburgh, and I guess just by default, I was always hill running because I lived next to like Arthur's Seat and the Hermitage and stuff. And Edinburgh is a pretty good city to be a hill runner or a trail runner in. And I don't know, for whatever reason, the thought of going out all day kind of appealed. So I did that, went out and ran around in the Pentlands and all this sort of stuff.
Who did you start off with? Were you on your own or with a club or?
God, I should have joined a club. Like, I often wonder how much better I would be if I joined, you know, the Edinburgh Uni Club or Carnethy when I was, you know, 20. No, I was just on my own, really. Like, initially I went running with a few flatmates, but then my interest outlasted theirs, and so I was just going out on my own, I suppose. I suppose getting into hill running, like doing races and stuff. I met a guy called Graham Nash,
right.
Who's best known for having done Ramsay's Round like 6 times or something, out in the Pentlands, and he just stopped to chat and asked if I was training for the Pentlands Skyline, which, well, I asked him what that was, and it's a race that goes around most of the tops in the Pentlands, and it was on the next weekend, so I thought that sounded like a good, reasonable thing to do.
Wow.
And so on and so forth, really.
Was that one of your first kind of races then, the Pentlands, or not, or?
I'd done this thing called the Mighty Deer Stalker, which is in the Borders, which is this sort of trail race, obstacle course race before that was really a thing. Like, the obstacles consist of, they've nailed planks across downhill mountain bike trails. Like
that. Right, okay, good.
That was the sort of level of finesse that was involved. But I've done that a few times. And, you know, enjoyed it. It's fun. It's pretty hilly. But the Pentland Skyline was my first proper hill race. And I remember being very nervous showing up because it's an AL race. So L, long, A, lots of climbing.
Did you have all the right kit, or did you had to beg and borrow?
I had all the right kit, but I didn't have all the right experience. Because, you know, it says somewhere on Carnethy's website that you should have done, you know, 2 AL races before you enter, which is kind of circular.
Yes.
It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And so I, you know, was kind of worried showing up at the Hill End ski slope to pay my £5 and get my race number. I was concerned that they were going to ask me for, you know, proof of relevant experience. That wasn't going to be a liability. But they didn't. So that was fine. I went out too hard, blew up horrendously, didn't eat any of the food that I had in my rucksack.
Oh, no. How long is it roughly? What sort of distance is that one?
It's 26 or 27 kilometres and 2,000 metres of climbing, maybe?
So it's a very ambitious first race to sort of do.
I think naive is probably a better word, but yeah.
Were you hooked after that and then just went on to bigger things, or?
Yeah, pretty much, I think. I started looking around for other races to do. At some point, I landed on the Jura Fell Race website and was just blown away by the photos. Of people running on the patch. They just looked impossibly rough, and it just looked amazing. And so I emailed the organizers to ask if I could enter, because that was another one where you need to have the relevant experience, but where they actually check, because there's maybe a bit more scope for things to go properly wrong.
Yeah.
And so I signed up to do that. And this, well, now you couldn't do it because the race is way oversubscribed. It is absolutely amazing. So it's justifiably popular, so I had to go and do something else
to qualify. Good. So in terms of your achievements, what would you say your greatest achievement is in terms of long distance running, because you've got a lot to your name? The bad weather record on Angelic, that's still yours, isn't it? That is still yours.
As far as I know, they've still only run the bad weather course once,
right?
And there were 21 people in the race that year. And of those, I was fortunate enough to be the fastest.
Excellent. It must have been pretty bad, though. The weather must have been pretty grim up there.
Do you know, that race is cursed.
Is it?
5 years. It's the second weekend in July.
All right.
And I don't know if they've ever had good weather for it. It's a fundraiser for the Mountain Rescue.
Right.
Like, you know, registration and tea and cake afterwards is in the Mountain Rescue base in Dundonald. And I think at least 2 occasions, Mountain Rescue have had to go out and look for runners.
And actually rescue people who've been
away and all this.
Wow.
But yeah, every year I'd give Ray Wilby £20 so that he doesn't put the bad weather route on.
Yeah, so you can keep your record. I think that's a great idea. That's the way to do it.
Yeah.
The Cairngorm 4000 record you had for some time. I'm not sure how long. This is stuff that I've just found out about you and I've been researching. I've got loads of stuff to spill.
I mean, that...
Your friend stole that one, didn't he?
That probably is the best thing I've done, actually. Yeah. That's about my best run. I do have the distinction of being the sort of shortest serving of the Cairngorm 4000's record holders. You know, most people get to keep that record for a decade, 20 years, something like that. I had it for a little over a year.
And then Finlay Wild stole it from you, didn't he?
Or Finlay broke it. And the fact that it was broken by Finlay is something I'm almost as proud of as the fact that I had it in the first place. Like, if you're going to lose it to anyone.
I just popped a picture of Finlay up there. Yeah, you can't, you don't really mind, do you, when you lose out to certain people?
Yeah, there's not a lot you can do about it.
No. So I know you say you've done quite a lot of the big rounds, or attempted some of the big rounds, and you say you've just had bad luck or bad planning or a bit of everything. What do you think? I know I was reading about it, it's like, oh, I've failed the Paddy Buckley rounds and I've failed the Bob Graham rounds. And it's not failure, is it? You've not done it in the time that you wanted or things have gone wrong, but it's still, you know, it's an achievement.
No, it's failure. Both of those attempts were in December.
All right.
So if you were to write a manual for how to succeed on the big rounds, you probably wouldn't put that in there. And the Bob Graham, I got right. I got back to Keswick in under 24 hours, but I missed the top of Sergeant Man.
Because,
it's the Lake District. They put cairns on everything. So I found this cairn and I was like, right, that's the... Anyway, everyone talks about the tops you missed. They don't talk about the ones you added.
All the ones that you didn't, all the extra ones that you did. Well,
I think I did at least one bonus Langdale Pike.
Yeah. Will you go back and do both of those again, do you think? Especially after this year with watching, being inspired by other people and things like that. Are there two that you'd like to go back to?
The Bob Graham thing, for all that it was unequivocally a failure, still one of the most... one of the most meaningful things I've done, I suppose. Like, I was on my own. I didn't have any support.
Right, wow.
I hadn't been on quite a lot of the route before. I hadn't wrecked it or anything. I just drove down to Keswick, had a cup of tea in a cafe, and then went off.
And navigated your way around the lake themselves.
Yeah, it was dark for 16 hours.
Wow.
And all the rest of it. And so that was being out on your own for that long, I find quite a satisfying thing. I'd beat the drum all day for doing things in that sort of style. I think the more you're relying on yourself, the more you're going to get out of it.
Yeah, that's true.
Which is not to say that it's wrong to go with all your club mates and mosey around on the shortest day of the year, but I sometimes feel like if that's all you ever do, then maybe you're missing out on this thing.
You like to make things difficult for yourself. That's definitely the way to make it hard, isn't it? On your own and December as well.
Yeah, maybe. I'd like to go back.
Whip round it in summer, couldn't you? No problem. But you like to make it a bit more challenging.
There's stuff I'd like to do in the lakes. I'd like to go and do Eric Beard's 24-hour record route, which would count as a Bob Graham because it's got all the tops in it, but it's also got 11 more.
Right, wow.
He was a guy, he ran it in 1963. He's a guy I'm sort of slightly obsessed with. There's a picture of him on the fridge over there. He did all sorts of stuff. He also had the Cairngorm 4000s record, the Coolin Ridge record, all these sorts of things. So I think that would be a really cool thing to go and do.
Yeah, definitely.
And yeah, the Paddy Buckley, again, in December with my friend Andy Berry, who is right now running the Steve Parr round, actually, in the lakes. That was a less interesting failure, actually. We got three or four legs in and it just sort of fizzled out.
Right.
I got really cold. He was really knackered.
And if there's no support as well, you can't warm up as easily and things like that, can you? It's more difficult.
Yeah, we just sort of decided that being up in the state we were in December probably wasn't witty. So we had a nice walk of shame back down to the road.
Well, lots to look at for the future, definitely, and things to make life difficult and rounds to go into yourself. Moving on to your book a little bit now. So this is your first book. You write anyway, don't you? I know you've written quite a lot for Fast Running and various articles and things like that. And you have a very humorous style. I do enjoy your style of writing. It's quite self-deprecating. You've got a little bit of fruity language in there as well, which we all like. So why did you decide to write this book?
I really wish I had a sort of better book origin story. Like, I should have been up a hill at sunrise and decided that I wanted to share the joy of running with the world. But actually, my friend Kirsty Reed, who works for Vertebrate, the publisher, texted me and asked if I wanted to write a book.
Wow.
So I said yes. She knew that I'd been spending quite a lot of my time watching people's GPS trackers and had time on my hands because I wasn't at work. And so she thought that there was probably a book in all the stuff that was going on. And I guess
there was a lot of rounds, weren't you? You were out supporting lots of people on different things.
Yeah, so that was the thing that kind of convinced me it was a viable idea, because I thought that writing just an almanac would be a bit dry, you know, just a list of who did what and when. And I think that, so I was out with Donnie Campbell and his Munro Round and Dan Lawson on Land's End to John O'Groats relatively briefly, a few other people. And I guess taking Land's End to John O'Groats as an example, because of the scale of it,
yeah,
most of the writing that you see about that is from this very zoomed out perspective, understandably. Like if it's just a news article, then it's, you know, 800 and something miles, 10 days. There's only so much fine detail you can go into. So I thought that writing about that stuff from a fairly nitty gritty first person perspective would maybe be a little different.
Yeah.
A little more insight into the sort of nuts and bolts of how those things actually work. Because
yeah,
I think for most people, you hear that someone ran for 10 days.
It doesn't mean anything, does it? I was out with a lady last night, and she was just saying that her husband had been out walking that day. She went, oh, and he's done 11 Wainwrights, and he's really chuffed with himself. And I said, oh, have you seen Serena? And she went, so how long did that take then? And I said, you know, just under 6 days. And she went, oh, he's rubbish then, isn't he? And she was so like, I was like, well, no, he's not rubbish, but this is something on a different level. And as you said, unless you write about all the detail in it for people who've not been involved in those sort of rounds, it's very, very difficult to understand the level of planning, the level of support, and everything else that's involved in it, isn't it?
And the people who are good at that sort of stuff, you know, like on the Wainwrights of the Land's End, John O'Groats or whatever, I think unless you've seen it firsthand or maybe tried to do it yourself, it's really difficult to understand just how much those people are capable of putting themselves through.
Yeah.
You know, you watch a GPS tracker and it's just moving along quite slowly. You don't really get a grasp of the substance of that. It's it's something I'm always in awe of.
Yeah.
People like Dan, Sabrina, whoever.
Yeah, it's I think it's very hard to understand. I think that's what I liked about your book, is that you do bring to life the really crappy bits of taking part in things like that. I used to do a few ultras, but I never did over 50 miles because after 4 or 5 hours, I've kind of had enough. And I get to 8 hours, I'm like, right, I want to stop, I'm done now. And to carry that on mountains and hills for 6 days without sleeping more than, you know, sort of 8 hours in the whole time, it's mind-blowing. I can't, as a runner myself, I can't comprehend it. It's really, really hard to think about, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's very, very difficult to put yourself in that situation of wanting to do it. So the question that people kind of want to know is, which is the most impressive record? And it's not one you can answer and say, oh, this was it. But in terms of you writing your book, which chapters and which people, or which bits from different chaps and different people did you particularly enjoy or particularly like?
Whoa! You've changed the question.
I'll go back. Which was the bit?
That's fine. Let's stick with that.
Okay.
People ask me what the most impressive records are all the time, and I try and like cycle through them.
Yeah, one of each interview different person.
I've lost track of where I am. So, in terms of things being favourites, I think that a lot of the most impressive runs sometimes don't actually get the credit they deserve. So if you look at what's a good example of that? So Kim Collison and James Stewart. Tim in the last 3 years has broken the winter Bob Graham record, the Lakeland 24-hour record, and he broke the Paddy Buckley record this year. James did the John Muir Way last year, the Fife Coast Path this year. And they're both just so consistent.
Yeah.
And they're really good. James is like fixture of the GB 24-hour squad, all that sort of stuff. And so, you know, you see that they're setting out to do something and you think, well, yeah, they're going to get it.
Yeah.
Obviously, like it's Kim. He's fit.
He's amazing,
done his homework. Same with James. And so you maybe find yourself jumping up and down less when they merit quite a lot of jumping.
Yeah, because you're used to seeing it, aren't you? You're used to reading about their successes and things like that.
Yeah. You just sort of
you expect it, don't you? Get
to it. Yeah. I do have favourites. There are a few records last year in the Cairngorms that I was delighted by. The women's record for the 4000s had been sitting there since the 80s sometime, and no disrespect to Kath Butler, it was pretty soft, and that was broken twice last year after, you know, 30 something years, so that was cool.
Who broke that one, sorry, can you just, I've not got it down, who broke the Cairngorm 4000 one?
Katie Henderson and Caroline Marwick. Katie is from Deeside. Caroline Marwick runs for Highland Hill Runners, as all the best people do.
Yeah.
And then, actually, Sasha Schepelin
broke
the 24-hour Monroe record last year, which is, you know, really impressive in and of itself. But he was 23 at the time, and his whole support crew, it was a joint attempt initially with Ali Masson, but they had all their pals supporting them, and I think all of them were 23 or younger.
Oh.
And all of them, like, shit hot hill runners.
Right.
Like, racers in your sort of traditional shorter distance.
Yeah.
And so to see, like, a group of guys like that getting their teeth into some of the long distance stuff so early and succeeding is really exciting.
It's
those
really
guys,
exciting, isn't it? Yeah.
How child friendly does this have to be, by the way? What's the time? 10 to 7.
<Love it. laughs>
The rest of us look silly for the next 15 years if they want to.
Yeah.
And you know, sometimes the long distance stuff can feel like it's the preserve of the crusty old dudes. So having
it's really exciting that younger people are looking at these rounds and going, "Oh, do you know what? I could try that," because in history it has been the older generation who tend to do these things because you want the experience, you want you know, your support crew and things like that. So it's very exciting when a lot of younger people are coming through and going out and doing things like this. It's a great time to be looking at records and things like that.
So hopefully they'll keep doing stuff and I can keep writing books about it.
Well, that's what I've just said. One of the guys has just come on and said that records are just being smashed everywhere. It's really hard to keep up. It seems like every week there's a new record broken. And I've just said, I've just said to Ali, he needs to write another book. You're going to have version two. You're going to have to do one every year now, it seems.
Oh, that'd be all right. Yeah,
that's it. And George has just come on and said that he's planning to run 100K next week with almost no training, just a few 10 to 20K runs. Am I crazy? You'll manage, George.
Everyone does stuff like that. It'll be a good story.
Things, haven't we? You just get through it, don't you? You just get through it. I was just going through some bits and bobs here. So other chapters from your book. I was trying to work out which people you've supported yourself on rounds. Can you tell us in your book which were the people you actually supported, or have you supported all of the people in the chapters in your book? I was trying to figure that one out.
Luckily, I've got a copy of it here, so I can tell
you. I've got a list of the chapters if you need some help.
My friend Ian Stewart.
Yeah.
I was out with him.
The two Stewarts.
Yeah, the one. And then Donnie and Dan and somebody else. This is bad, isn't it?
No, it's fine.
John Kelly.
Oh yeah, of course.
I was at John on his grand round thing.
And so the other people, the chapters for people that you didn't actually support, how did you go about sort of writing that? Did you set up quite a lot of interviews with the people who've done these rounds and find out information from them directly?
I don't know if I'd go so far as to call them interviews. I phoned them up. And talk to them. And most of these people have got quite interesting things to say, which is good. Yeah. Saves things being too dry. And I would have liked to get out with more people, support more people. Like my friends who live in the lake, I'm always really envious of, because they're out on Bob Graham or Wainwright's support.
Every weekend, every day.
Yeah. But, you know, it's whatever it is, 6 hours from here to the lakes.
Yeah, it's a long way.
And not as many people come try and do things near my house.
No,
which is inconsiderate of them.
It is. We need to get quite a lot of people up to Granton on Spey, getting some records done up in the Cairngorms, yeah. Definitely.
I mean, that would involve them, I don't know, going running in the Cromdales.
You're not a fan, are you?
Not something I would wish on anyone.
Is it the heather? Is it just heather and peat bogs all the time?
Yeah, like, I remember last year, do you remember we had 6 weeks pretty much of sunshine?
Lockdown was beautiful. March, April, May.
It was, you know, hot for here. It was 20 something degrees most days.
Yeah.
And like towards the end of that, I went for a run in the Cromdales and I was up to my knees in bog on the tops of the hills. It's like water doesn't flow downhill.
No, why is it there? It's just not good, is it?
It's like it's got its own physical laws, which are all designed to make sure that it's a shitty experience for anyone who goes around there.
That's what I like in your book, and that's what I like in your articles on fast running. That it's like, oh yeah, everyone says go to Aviemore, go and run in the hills on Aviemore, it's amazing, and you're like, it's not, it's crap. Don't come and run on the Cromdales, and you look at the hills in the distance, and you're like, yeah, I want to get to there, but you can't because you've got this really horrible bit of running here as well. And that's what I like about the book, is that you tell the bad bits, because everyone who's on here watching, people who watch this after, running's, it's good, but it's also really bad, isn't it? And you know, people who start running and they've got that sort of joy of it for a while, and then they start to move on to other things, and you choose your level that you're comfortable at. And when you're doing sort of long runs and you're up in the mountains and stuff, there's days and bits of days that are pretty grim, really. I like that you put that in the book and that you share that as well. One of the things I wanted to ask you was, what did you leave out the book? What did you not cover? Are there any things that you left out that you think, I wish I'd have put that in, or I didn't get round to covering that one?
Loads.
Yeah.
Loads, yeah. I mean, I had a fairly... I was going to say I had a fairly tight deadline for writing it. I thought I did, and then I missed the deadline and the world didn't end, so obviously it wasn't that tight. But I had to sort of cut it off at the end of Donny Campbell's Munro round, which was just the very start of September.
Right.
And obviously loads of interesting stuff happened
after that. Yeah.
Like, there was Carol Morgan's 24-hour record in the lakes. There was George Foster's Bob Graham. Loads of stuff. And then there were a few things, like I already mentioned Sasha Shevlin and Kim Collison, who had the two 24-hour records. I just couldn't quite make it work. Like, it didn't feel like I was choosing to leave them out at all. It was just that they felt a bit redundant with other chapters that would have been looking at similar things. There was already some stuff from the Lake District and some stuff from the Cairngorms, so there was overlap there.
I should tag Vertebrae Publishing, because someone's just said, yeah, there's plenty of material for book two then.
I tell you what, actually, is this a bad thing? It probably is a bad thing. If I could go back, I think I would have a chapter about those guys.
Yeah.
And I would take out the chapter about the Wainwrights.
Yes.
For a couple of reasons. I don't know if I ever quite got it nailed down and did it justice, because it was like Sabrina's run last year. There was a whole debacle. It was so dramatic during the thing and then after the thing, and there was like the first attempt where she got told to go home by the police.
Yeah.
And like it's
bizarre, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I don't know if I ever quite conveyed how incredible that various stuff was. But then when I was speaking to Sabrina, the note that the chapter initially ended on,
yeah,
was her saying that she felt a bit bad because she kind of ruined it.
Yeah.
And now she suspected that the first woman to do the Wainwrights wouldn't get the credit they deserved. And so she was going to go back and do it again and do it better.
Yeah.
And that's cool. That's fine. But then just before I submitted the manuscript for the book, Mel Stevenson went out and did all the Wainwrights, and Sabrina's prediction was entirely correct because comparatively nobody came. Like, she got a fraction of the attention that Sabrina got when she did it. And it was just a bummer.
Yeah.
Having
you
that.
You feel sorry for the people who haven't got the recognition, don't you? It's tricky, isn't it?
Whereas writing a book this year, now, with Sabrina finally getting it finished, that would be a much better story, I suppose.
Yeah, well, I've just flashed up here. So, you know, the BBC News from 5 hours ago on the BBC News website showing, you know, that Sabrina Virgil on record run across the Cumbrian Wainwrights. You know, when you're in the BBC, it's...
And I know Sabrina to talk to. I don't know particularly well. I wasn't that involved or invested in that round. But I still, when she finished, I just felt relieved.
Yes.
Because, like, after last year's mess and then this year,
then the winter,
first attempt, it's so unequivocally shut down by the weather.
Yeah.
Like, if it hadn't worked out this time, you'd be thinking she was cursed.
Yeah. Or something. You were really starting to feel for her, weren't you? And then when she set off, I've only met her once when we were in the lakes doing some sock testing. And she's great. She's very sort of modest and very, she's lovely. And I'm really chuffed that she's got it ticked off, almost like that done after, you know, third attempt, really, isn't it?
It's a lot of hours to sort of, isn't it?
Training, planning, everything, really, isn't it? It's what we've done there. Training, planning, and everything. It's tricky, isn't it? So some of the things that we popped on to ask you were, put that back on there. Ooh, where's it gone? They were strange one, actually. I'll come back to some of this. The worst running moments of your life. I didn't realise I put that one on there. This would be an interesting one. Your personal life, the worst running moments that you've had. You could have written these in your book as well. See, I think a chapter about you would have been quite nice, but I know that's not really your style, is it?
I mean, I've had some horrible races.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's anything that stands out. I mean, the worst bits have been bad because they've been prolonged.
Yeah.
Right? So it's not so much a moment. Like, I did a race in the Basque Country a couple of years ago, which was 100 miles, and I didn't feel right from the start, and about 3 hours in, I was just sore all over. I still don't really know why. And so I pretty much walked 80 miles.
That's all right for the guy who's doing 100k next week. George, you'll be all right. You can just walk some.
yeah, just each aid station or whatever. Break it up however you like, however you can.
Yeah.
So that's pretty grim. Most of these have been situations of my own making.
Yeah.
You know, like, you go out too hard and then you have a horrible time in the second half or whatever it might be. I don't think I've never had serious injuries. I've never, like, I did get very sick once after a race in Andorra. I think I drank something funny, drank from the wrong stream or something. But by that point, I was fortunately, like, back in a hotel.
Yeah, feeling ill.
If that had come on a little sooner, that might have been unpleasant. But I had a horrible time at the Alm, actually.
Oh.
The original marathon. My friend Charlie Sprosen convinced me to do it. Against my better judgment.
Do
because
the summer one, it's far nicer. The On Light is beautiful. Don't do the winter one.
Set up to be miserable.
Yeah.
But I went in with this ankle thing that was a thing but not quite serious enough to stop me from doing it. But it was in Galloway.
Right.
And yeah. Galloway is like,
I know Galloway.
Bromdale's, but worse.
I was just going to say that. It's just Heather City, isn't it? Yeah. Oh, is it where Merrick and Merrick Hill and places like that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we walked the entirety of the second half of the first day because I fell down this hole and like hyperextended my bad ankle.
Oh, no.
But, you know, even then, silver lining, we had the clarity to just drop out rather than spending 14 hours of uncomfortable pillow talk in a tiny tent. We just went to the pub, which was quite pleasant.
Better way to do it.
We felt pretty smug, everyone else, like spooning in their Terra Nova lasers, and we were just having
drinks
a meal.
Happy days.
Yeah.
One of the things I found out about you, Ali, that I'm going to share, you know I'm going to say this because this was my highlight. The book's great, but this is even better.
Yeah, so
you might not know this at home, but Ali actually has a 2:12 marathon PB, okay? You think Eliud Kipchoge's good. This guy's on another level. But there is something to add here. So Ali's marathon PB came on rollerblades. Now, as a roller skater and ice skater myself, this made my day. So it's Ali's favourite picture of himself. He's going to use it as his. I've just put it up there for you. Who took that, did you say?
John Kelly. He was running the marathon because he's an idiot.
Yeah, and you were roller skating it.
I was doing it on rollerblades.
So this was Berlin Marathon, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And you did it twice.
Yeah.
So if anybody wants something different to do, rollerblading Berlin Marathon is apparently the way to do it. That's apparently the best way to do it and the most fun.
I mean, as much as I did it for, you know, a bit of a laugh and it's a hoot and a giggle, it is seriously the best way to do the Berlin Marathon. It's on the Saturdays, the day before.
Right.
The course is I think slightly different in one or two places, like to avoid tram lines or something that would cause all sorts of carnage. So you still get the same like tour of this European city. It's like snooker table flat. But the skating marathon, well, the running marathon starts at 8 in the morning.
Right.
So all the marathon runners are getting up at 4 to eat whatever gruel passes for breakfast.
Yeah.
And then like standing around shivering in a bin bag before the start with 40,000 other people.
Yeah.
The skating marathon starts at 3:00 in the afternoon.
Oh, nice.
So you can sleep in.
Sightsee.
Go to like some really trendy modern art gallery, have like a boozy lunch somewhere, wander over to the Brandenburg Gate. It's 5,000 people, so it's still a lot of people, but there's a lot less competition for Portaloos than there is at the running marathon. It's just more fun. Like, the actual activity is more fun, and it beats you up a lot less.
I think we need a Wild Ginger Running trip organised to a Berlin roller skating, rollerblading marathon, definitely.
It's a shame that you couldn't really have it anywhere in the UK, because, like,
the road
isn't good enough,
which is
a shame. I should make it clear, by the way, that 2:12 is crap.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. Like it's nothing to brag about. The course record there is 56:49.
Wow.
So they're skating at 50 kilometers an hour.
Wow.
They're really quick. So yeah.
You don't want to fall.
No. No, I imagine you get some pretty impressive road rash.
Wow. There you go. So, yeah, that's see, when I asked you about, you know, greatest achievements, I think that's a pretty good one, actually. I think that's a great one to have. Not running, but, you know, still as good.
They do publish, by the way, results.
Oh, do they?
You've done both.
Right.
Which intrigues me, but not enough to go and run the Berlin Marathon. It tends to be people who are pretty shit hot on skates. So they're just over an hour.
Yeah.
And people who are like just maybe around 3 hours a little under the next day.
Right.
So I think that's, I think someone who was, you know, a 2:30 club runner.
Yeah.
Spent just a little while getting to grips with rollerblades could go out and do pretty well.
Yeah. Ooh. Tempting. Well, going back to the book a little bit, how long did it take to write the book? I know you were talking about deadlines and things, but and how did you actually go about it? Were you sat at your computer a lot, or did you find time to like doing it? How did you go about it?
I was sat at my computer a lot, which doesn't mean that I was writing a lot. I went about it very poorly.
Right.
So I first spoke to Kirsty about it sometime in July, mid or late July. And then there was I signed a contract, which is the most grown up thing I've done in my life, I think. Sometime in early August.
Yeah.
And, you know, they were saying it would be great if we could have it out in time for Christmas, because, you know,
presents, yeah.
And, you know, in an ideal world, that would mean we'd have a finished manuscript at the end of August.
That is a tight deadline, isn't it? That's a really tight deadline.
It is. I mean, that's the one that flew right by. I missed that completely. I think I got it handed in by the end of September. So the whole process was about 7 weeks.
Wow.
And I've no frame of reference. Because I've only ever written one book, but apparently that's not very long.
No.
But it was kind of necessary to do that way, because it's a very, I mean, the year is on the cover of the book, right? It's of its time.
And I suppose things are changing so quickly as well, aren't they? Especially last year, you kind of got to do it, get it published before things change again, and it's sort of out.
Yeah. I think if I was to do it again, I'd like to think I'd be a little more organized. Right. I'd work a little more efficiently. I probably wouldn't.
No.
Just, I can't actually remember ever sitting down and writing. So I don't know where the words actually came from. They just sort of congealed over the period of a month and a half from like fragments that I must have typed sometime. I'm not very, it reminded me of being a student and my sort of working practices that I developed there, which involved lots of scraps of paper with lots of scraps of thoughts written on them,
and then suddenly having deadlines that you have to hit.
Exactly. Which and if it wasn't for those deadlines, I'd still be writing. It was very useful to have. I was about to have someone breathing down your neck. There was none of that, but you know, have a sort of end date when you had to have stuff finished.
One of the other things in the book that I particularly liked is your chapters about support crew and the people that you acknowledge in the book. I think you talk about Dan Lawson's wife and Ian Stewart's wife and Nikki, is it Ligo? And about their role in actually helping so much on these Fastest Known Times, these records that were broken last year. Because they are part of the record, aren't they? Very much so.
Completely. Yeah.
And I think their role is overlooked as well, isn't it? So could you just tell us a little bit about, you know, what you say in the book and your views of the sort of support network that these runners have in order to produce these Fastest Known Times as well?
A few people. It really stands out, the difference. I mean, obviously, they've only done it once. They've never done it with a shitty crew, so we don't really have a control group. But you assume that having the right people there was really pivotal for them. And like Dan Lawson, it wasn't just his wife. It's Robbie Britton, who's his coach and was sort of the mastermind of the route and all this stuff.
And the humour for the trip, I'm quite sure, Robbie.
I don't know if it would always have been appreciated, but yeah.
He'd still be trying.
I can't remember Mitch's surname. Mick Seymour? I might have just made that up. Who's been like a crewing fixture for the GB Ultra squad for years. So he knows Dan really well. He's worked with him in that sort of environment a lot. And Dan speaks of them in absolutely glowing terms, which is what he's like. I mean, he'd probably speak about them in those terms, even if they were horrible.
Yeah.
And actually being horrible is part of their job sometimes. Sometimes carrot, sometimes stick. And so because they know him so well, they know how hard they can push him productively. And when when it stops being productive, how to fix it.
Yeah.
When you need to sleep, when you need to eat, when you need to just get on with it.
So for people who don't know much about it, in terms of on these long distance attempts, what do support crews actually do? Because I think unless you've seen it in action, it's quite hard to actually understand, isn't it?
I mean, everything, pretty much. Like Dan in particular is not a detail guy. Like he does all these incredible things. There's people who will show up to like a 6-day race, like a 6-day track race, which is the sort of thing that Dan does. And they will have like lap splits for 6 days. And Dan does not do that. Apparently you start talking to him about calories per hour or kilometers an hour or whatever, and you can just see him glazing over. He just isn't interested. And so for him, he just wants to run, just wants to get into his happy place and shuffle up the side of some dual carriageway for the whole day. And so his crew are feeding him. They're arranging where they're going to be that night. On something like Land's End to John O'Groats, they're probably also like messaging people who are going to come out and run with him, because Robbie did a lot of it with him on the bike, but he can't do all of it.
Yeah.
So organising that kind of thing, running off, getting his food, just everything.
Foot care as well, sorting out feet, drying feet off, changing shoes, socks.
There's a really good video of when he got to Aviemore, one of the things Robbie asked me to do was to find someone who would let Dan have a bath in their house.
Oh, no way.
So, and I succeeded. My friend Martin Bell was like, yeah, sure, this guy I've never met can come and have a bath in my house at 10:30 at night. That's totally fine. there's a video of Mick Seymour carrying Dan downstairs
after he's been in
that, because he's so knackered. And he's just like, fortunately, Dan's a pretty small guy.
Yeah.
And Nicky Ligo is an interesting case, actually, because the other two people you mentioned there were like Laura McCauley and Charlotte, Dan's wife, you know, spouses and family members. Yeah. You can kind of understand that they are not obliged, but whatever.
Long suffering, aren't you? It's one of those things, isn't it?
And Nicky rocks up and does this stuff for people that she, not necessarily people she barely knows, but, you know, people who aren't family.
Mm.
And who are doing these things that are multiple days long. She always says she works at the spine rate.
Yeah, I was just reading about her the other day, actually, just to have a look at stuff. And yeah, it sounds like she's pretty amazing with what she does.
Yeah, and like, she gets less sleep than the runners do.
Yeah.
On John's Pennine Way record last year, she slept less than John. And John didn't sleep very much.
Wow.
And she just, I don't know, she loves it. Like she's kind of a fan. In a lot of ways, like she's very impressed by what
people do.
And I think that she feels lucky, privileged to be asked by people to be a part of something that means so much to them.
Yeah.
And I think that might be, you know, a lot of the people who run Bob Graham support all the time, you know, they're Cumbrians. They probably wouldn't put it in those terms. It's a bit too gushy, right?
Yeah.
But I think that's a big part of it. You know, like someone's Bob Graham can be the best day of their life.
Yeah.
And so just asking to be involved is a great thing.
Yeah. It's quite reflective of the running community as well, isn't it? That people will give up time to help other people and to help train other people and help them navigate and look after them. And it's why it's very different to road running, I think, isn't it? It's a totally different ball game. Being out on the fells and things, and the support that you get from people, it's totally different, isn't it?
And I guess there's a bit of a quid pro quo thing going on. Like people go out and support people on Bob Graham's, and then when it's their turn, people show up to help them out. And actually, Joe Meek, who was on the cover of the book, ran the Dartmoor round last year. She was really reluctant to ask people to come out and help.
Why?
She felt like she was imposing and.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of them are, a lot of her support group are farmers, I think. So she was, you know, conscious that she was taking them away from work and stuff.
Yeah.
And so she, you know, really tentatively go and ask people and, you know, in quite an apologetic way. And they're like, it's all right. Like, I like running. That's, you're asking me to come out and do the thing that I like doing.
Yeah.
not a burden. It's not an imposition. Like, but yeah, cool. I'm carrying a couple of extra sandwiches. That's fine.
I don't know much about the Dartmoor round. How long, roughly, is that? I don't know an awful lot about it.
Neither did many people. Until last year, it had only had five completions, I think.
Right.
And, Joe's record was 1640 something. Right. So it's that sort of scale.
Yeah, yeah. She's a phenomenal ultra runner, isn't she? She's a
She's got weekends. She's done a bunch of stuff already this year as well. Some race records and some shorter records in Dartmoor.
Yeah.
I think she had this marathon lined up that never happened. So she had this block of really hard training and then
needed something. Has
like unleashed it all on this other stuff. She's a class act. But the Dartmoor round actually has pretty interesting origins. There was a guy called Nigel Jenkins who did it. If you thought my attempts at the Bob Graham and stuff were bad, he tried to do it on the 31st of December, 1999.
Wow.
It was a way of marking the new year. In horrendous weather. Some of his descriptions of crossing the rivers on Dartmoor, which are notorious, people die in those rivers pretty regularly, are just terrifying. Like, I think if you showed them to people who specialize in whitewater safety, they would probably be appalled. Just horrendous weather, and I made it back to the pub in time for last orders. Got most of the way through his pint of Guinness and fell asleep, apparently. But it's great. One of the reasons Joe wanted to do the round was to kind of show people that there's cool running in the Southwest.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
most people don't really see that as an area for decent running, do they? You think Lakes, Scotland, and that's Wales. That's pretty much as far as people tend to go, isn't it, really?
Yeah. And so she'd got together all this crew of all the big names of Southwest trail running, like all the people who'd done the round before her were there.
Where's
and...
she based? She's not Southern at all, is she? She's...
Yeah, she stays. She's that's why she ended up doing it. So she was off work and all the usual stuff, and all the races were cancelled, and she was injured.
Right.
She did a load of these backpacking, fastpacking trips across Dartmoor. I think does she live in Devon, but she's from Cornwall.
All right.
Maybe the other way around.
Right.
I can't remember, something like that. Yeah. Yeah. It's like her local.
Right. I didn't realise that. I thought it was somewhere else. I've got the wrong place in my head. So why are you so interested in fastest known times then? That's the other thing that I wanted to ask.
Just a bit of a train spotter, maybe?
Is that what it is? Is it the nerd of running that's coming out?
Yeah, I mean, I like hill running. I've always enjoyed reading about it. There's something about the really long stuff that is quite interesting. Not all the records are really long, but a lot of them have a lot of history.
And how it used to be done as well, and then the advancements in shoes, clothing, and everything else brings it to a different level, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I think people talk about, you know, the advantages that runners have now that they didn't have when Joss Naylor was doing stuff, or when Martin Stone was knocking about in the late 80s. I mean, he's still very much knocking about, but he's not knocking as far.
Yeah.
And, you know, the kit is better. Like, race vests are better than, you know, the canvas rucksacks that people might have been using back then. But I think the understanding of how those efforts on that scale should be done has improved a lot. Because if you look at the Lakeland 24-hour record, for example, the last, all the people who've broken it since Joss Naylor, none of them would get close to Joss Naylor at the Innerdale Horseshoe, for example. Like, as physical specimens, they are less good than he was, which is in no way a negative thing to say. But you look at their splits for these things, and Joss Naylor and all his contemporaries approached these things the same way they approached a fell race. Like, you went out really hard and you're gone.
And kept going hard.
Yeah, like Mark Hartel. Was it Mark Dermot or Hartel? whoever was first to break Naylor's record, at halfway, they were about an hour behind Joss Naylor's splits. But they just kept going. The Eric Beard record that I mentioned earlier, his first leg from Keswick to Threlkill, pretty much BG leg one, but with the addition of Skiddaw Little Man. He did it in 2:21, which is a minute slower than George Foster did on his 13:44 Bob Graham.
Right, wow.
So he went out
fast. Yeah.
Unbelievably fast. But then between there and the end, he spent almost 2 hours sitting in chairs.
Right.
Like he just, you know, stopped for a sandwich because you've got to eat your honey sandwiches sometime.
Yeah.
And when Kim Collison broke that record last year, he stopped twice to take the stones out of his shoes.
Right, gosh.
And that was it. Like less than 5 minutes total, right. Stopping. And so just the understanding of how to measure an effort, the logistics of making things a bit slick. It's probably a pretty big difference.
Yeah. It's good how, I think, the last year, everyone seems to become more interested in the records that have been broken and stuff like that. There has, you know, a lot of people talking about it. There's a lot more awareness of the records that are out there. And I think a lot more people are inspired. Having time or, you know, not being working and things like that, they've had a lot more time to get out when you're allowed and look at things like that and set challenges as well. And I think for a lot of people, it helped keep them focused on running as well. Because I think I found running a challenge last year. And I think setting a challenge, something like that, means you have to go out, you have to do it, you have to keep your hours up and stuff like that. So I suppose we'll start to round things up. And do you have a favourite chapter in your book then? Doesn't have to be the best record. You can get out of it this way. You're not saying to someone, you know, you're not downgrading anybody's record. But in terms of your favourite chapter, which one do you think is your favourite chapter?
Oh, sorry. I don't need to look. The last one.
Yeah.
Stephen Poulton.
Yeah.
I might get some of these details wrong because I've not read the book in a while, obviously.
I won't know. I think I just finished that one the other night, actually.
So Stephen Poulton in 1983,
wasn't it? Was it 83 or 82? Was it between 81 and 83? Because it wasn't far off when I was born. That's what I was thinking when I was listening to it.
So about 40 years ago.
Yeah.
Poulton set the record for the National Three Peaks by bike.
Yeah.
So from... not Conwy, wherever, somewhere at sea level in Wales.
Yeah.
Cycle to Snowdon, run up and down, cycle to Gaffel Bike, and a little finish at sea level again in Fort William.
Yeah.
And then last year, he did the trip again. He is now, I think he was 73 years old.
Wow.
And he did it, he cycled to the start, which was a 2-day trip from his house.
Wow.
And then he did that, and he was on his own. Like the first time he had the van and the racing bike and all this stuff. This time he was just doing it as a cycle tour, sleeping in ditches, being in public toilets. He sent someone a brilliant message talking about his delight at finding the public toilets in Glencoe. Because, you know, you pay 50p to get in and it's warm and you've got and all this stuff. He's got this, like, square of foam to put under his hip. That's his mattress. And I loved it.
Yeah.
Just the,
it's simple and brutal, that, isn't it? Both together,
But you've got this, you know, window in your life where you're going to be at your best for breaking records and doing things fast. And once that's gone, like, I just found it maybe comforting to think that you can still be involved in this sort of stuff in different ways. Like there are different ways to be engaged with, like, really long journeys on foot, on bike.
Absolutely.
Whatever. He's just an incredible dude, really. His plan had been to go from Fort William and cycle home via the four corners of the UK.
Wow.
But he had some health problems that meant that that didn't happen. But yeah, I really enjoyed talking to him.
Yeah,
and it was the fresh air after all these, like, lycra clad.
Yeah, that's impressive. That, and that's I think where everyone would aspire to, isn't it? To be 60-odd still doing
basically things. I want to be like him in 40 years.
Absolutely. In 40 years. How old are you?
What year is it? I'm 33.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? That's the aim, definitely, I think. All the records that you can do are fine, but when you're older, you still want to be able to go out and do the things that you love doing.
Yeah. When I was septuagenarian, I aspired to be sleeping in service station car
parks. In car toilets. Yeah. Brilliant. Well, thank you ever so much, Ali, for coming on tonight. It's been amazing speaking to you. I've really enjoyed it. We'll make sure there's a link posted up underneath the broadcast to your book so people can have a look at that. Any questions that people have, feel free to leave them in the comments and I will get back to you. So thank you very much, Ali, and we'll just close things off. So good night, people, and thank you very much for joining us. Bye.
Hi, it's Claire here. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. These live chats take place every Wednesday evening at 6:30 p.m. UK time on Wild Ginger Running YouTube channel. And the link is in the show notes. I just wanted to let you know that you can find this and loads more advice and inspiration and gear tests all about trail and ultra running on my YouTube channel, Wild Ginger Running. There are training tips, advice from elite athletes, top coaches, nutritious recipes, key exercises, injury prevention information, and tons of trail kit reviewed, from running packs to poles, waterproofs to head torches, GPS watches, and shoes. And did I mention shoes? I've been going for a few years now, so there's a huge archive of content to help you out with your trail and ultra running. To quickly and easily find the information you need, simply type your query into the Google search box and then write Wild Ginger Running after it. Then Google will show you whatever blog posts or films I have on that topic. Give it a try. And if you appreciate listening and all the information I share on YouTube, you're also very welcome to support me on Patreon, which gets you some additional excellent perks and the chance to win some awesome prizes. For as little as the price of a cup of coffee every month, patrons get discounts, extra films, access to the exclusive Facebook and Strava groups, the chance to ask questions to every live chat guest, plus automatic entry into my monthly competition to win £400 worth of trail and ultra running gear. There are only about 150 patrons, so the odds on a win are way better than the lottery. Interested? Find me at patreon.com/wildgingerrunning. Thanks for listening, guys. Have fun, enjoy your run, and I'll see you on the trails.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional unprofessional, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.